The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Light of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish thought and practice based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKolel, Dean of the Kolel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America. This lecture, titled How to Change Your Luck, is dedicated to the memory and the Ilui Nishmos Eliezer Nosson ben Gedalia Leib Kreitman and Shlomo ben Yehuda Stepsky Aleihem HaSholem of blessed memory.
In the English language, no blessing is more appreciated than the blessing, good luck. Amongst Jews throughout the world, every joyous occasion, whether it be a wedding, birth, bris, or bar mitzvah, is inevitably accompanied by the Hebrew equivalent of good luck, the ubiquitous blessing, mazel tov. For Jew and Gentile alike, mazel, or luck, seems to play an inordinate role in life. And we're often not satisfied just letting the luck or mazel that's in store for us run its own course. Sometimes we try actively to change our luck. Some run to holy men for their blessings. Others carry with them amulets or precious stones. Is this all merely an illusion? Does luck or mazel really exist? And if it really does exist, is there any way to change it? Is there a quick fix, so to speak? Is there indeed a tried and true proven method to change one's fortune? Probably the best way to summarize tonight's lecture is with the following apocryphal story. There was once a very pious man. We'll call him Moshe. A person who never failed to daven three times a day. He was meticulous in the observance of all the mitzvahs. But unfortunately, he was dogged with bad luck. He was never successful with anything. As much as he tried, it just didn't go. And he felt there was a juncture in his life that just enough was enough. He couldn't take it anymore. And he stood up to daven. He said, Hashem, God of the universe, you have so much to offer, and you've given me so little. Would it be so hard for you? Just one small gift. I'd like to win the lottery. You know, someone's got to win. It might as well be me. The week passed. Moshe did not win the lottery. This time, he was, despite his faith that had kept him going, but there were strains already. He was getting angry. And he said, I've been such a good person all my life. There's no one more deserving than I. Why can't I win the lottery? A week passed by. Moshe did not win the lottery. The third time, it's the third week already, he's getting very angry. And he's screaming and he's crying. And suddenly, a voice came from heaven. It says, Moshe, meet me halfway. Buy a ticket. The purpose of this lecture is to find out where can you obtain this proverbial ticket. I've divided this lecture, as you see in the handouts, into seven sections. The first letter of every section spelling the word fortune. There's fate, ordained, recklessness, teshuvah, uplifting, negativity, endurance. The first place to start, of course, is to find out, does luck or mazel really exist? All the Talmudic sources seem to point that it really does. there really is such a thing as mazel. If you have on page 2 of your notes, the first quote that we have is this paragraph A. It's taken from the Talmud, the tractate Shabbos, 156a. Here we have the opinion of Rabbi Chanina. The mazel is the cause, gives wisdom. The mazel gives wealth. And the fate of Israel is controlled by mazel. There's definitely an idea. What it is, we're going to greater detail. But there is an idea of something is fated. One truly has a mazel. The next quote, we have the paragraph B, is taken from another tractate. This is Moyet Cotton. This is Chof Chesom Adalef in 28a, which points out a unique facet of this idea of mazel. Rava, one of the prominent scholars or sages of the Talmud, made an oft-quoted statement. Chaye boni umezoini, the length of life, children, and sustenance depend not on merit, but rather on mazel. In other words, it really doesn't depend if one is righteous or not righteous. What's bashert for a person, at least he is going to get. And he brings a historical support to this thesis. In the generation before Rava, there were two great masters, Rava and Rav Chisda. And as I said, you could read the quote here. They're both saintly rabbis. In times of drought, when they prayed, rain came. And yet one was blessed with long life. Rav Chisda lived to be 92. He had many children, married them off. He was wealthy. And yet Rava lived a relatively short life. His children died. And he almost had nothing to eat. Why this is so is something we're going to explain soon. But again, we have the idea that something is fated, which is not readily changed. The third quote here puts some of this together. When is this determined? When is the fate of a person's life determined? And the Talmud says, as a Gemara Nidan Tezayin Amud Beis in 16b, that at the time of conception, that's when the determination is created. In Midrashic form, the Talmud quotes the idea that an angel comes before the great throne of God and asks God, what will be the fate of this child? Will he be strong or weak? Be wise or foolish? Be rich or poor? And at that point, his life is mapped out. What that person is going to do with that life, however, is not mapped out. Because after all, we have free will. What's determined is the playing field. We don't all play on the same field. And we all have unique challenges. And that's determined even before we are born. Why should this be so? That's something we're going to speak of in a few minutes. But the first idea is, yes, there is, at least according to Talmudic sources, mazel. Life is fated. The root of the word mazel, where does it come from? Is related to another Hebrew word, nozel, which means to flow or drip. Just as liquid flows by virtue of gravity from a higher to a lower place, so too is the course of our life. Its source flows, so to speak, from a higher source. It's nozel, it comes down, it flows. Just as an aside, the Talmud, by the way, maintains that everyone has a guardian angel. This angel is also referred to in the Talmud as mazel. There's a Gemara, there's a passage in the Talmud, in Beis Amud Beis in 2b, where we have the expression, Adam Islay Mazla. A person has mazel, he has a guardian angel, meaning there's a higher force that guides the person and provides protection. So the first idea that we want to posit is, yes, there is mazel, it's fated, and it's created by God himself. Is there some way for us to know what's in store for us? It'd be nice to know. What's our mazel? There was an ongoing argument between the mystics and the rationalists about the idea, is there a way to determine one's mazel? It seems that the sages of the Talmud believed in the efficacy of astrology, that through astrology one could determine the mazel. There are a whole school of rabbis, the most renowned is the Rambam, whose opinion is that of modern scholars, secular scholars, that astrology doesn't work. It's an inexact, it's not even a science. And according to that opinion, really, we can't look at the stars to find out what our mazel is, what our luck is. There is, however, the majority of rabbinic opinion, though, maintains that at least in the ancient form, there was a means of finding out one's mazel through astrology. By the way, one is not allowed by Jewish law to look at one's horoscope or to seek an astrologer. The reason is something, again, we're going to discuss a little later in the lecture. But whether it's foolishness or whether we can really predict our mazel, one should not go to an astrologer. What about palm reading? I'm sure all of you have heard stories about palm readers. I don't know if there exists any controlled scientific study about the ability of palm readers to truly determine one's future. However, there are very interesting anecdotes that seem to bear witness that there really seems to be something there. I'd like to read to you the following story. This is taken from the book The Scent of Snowflowers. It was written by a Holocaust survivor, Rivka Leah Klein, who describes her experiences in Hungary, how she was able to hide, she was able to falsify documents, to claim she was an Aryan, and to save her life in the Holocaust and the life of her husband and many of her relatives. Unfortunately, not all of her relatives survived. And she describes a conversation that she had with her sister Tzivia that happened many years before. And I'm quoting from this book. It was an unusually hot July afternoon, and we had gone to the ice cream parlor for some refreshment. We're sitting enjoying our ice cream, a very rare and expensive treat for us, when all of a sudden a gypsy girl appeared before us and grabbed Sivia's hand to read her palm. Sivia struggled to free her hand because the girl looked so frightening and because palm reading is forbidden by the Torah. But the gypsy was stronger than Sivia and would not release her. She began to read her, quote, fortune. You will marry next spring, she intoned. Your husband will earn his living with his two hands doing hard physical labor. In spite of Tzivia's continued struggles to free herself, the gypsy went on. You're going to have 1, 2, 3, 4 sons. And then without any warning, she began to wail and covered her eyes with her hands. She wailed as though the world were coming to an end. Oh, miss, how awful! I see a terrible, unending fire. Oh, how it burns! And she kept on wailing as though her heart were breaking. I looked at my sister and saw that she was staring at the gypsy, frightened beyond words. I tried to comfort her, but I couldn't reach her. She was in a state of shock. "Don't tell me that you believe her," I exclaimed. "She's crazy. Don't you realize that? You're not even 16 years yet. So of course you won't marry next spring. And you know as well as I do that when you do marry, your husband will be a student fresh out of yeshiva, not a manual laborer. Besides, Jews don't believe in palm reading." I began to feel genuinely frightened because Tzivia was beyond reach. In desperation, I thrust my hand out to the gypsy, certain that she would predict something equally crazy for me too, and thereby break the spell she had cast on my sister. "Do you see what you did to her?" I whispered furiously to the girl. "Tell me the same thing too." I felt the girl's firm grip on my hand as she turned it palm up, and I fervently prayed that she would tell me the same future, would wail as hysterically as she had when she predicted the all-consuming, unending fire for my sister. But to my dismay, as she began to speak, entirely different words came out, and I cursed her in my heart, for I had done what I had been taught was forbidden for the love of my sister, and the gypsy had ruined everything. She goes on in this book to say that the gypsy was accurate in her predictions. She did marry that spring, and her husband was a manual laborer who worked hard in a print shop, operating machines manually before he was drafted in the Hungarian slave force. She had four sons. And as it was, she was killed with her four little boys in Auschwitz. This evidently was the all-consuming fire. Again, it's only an anecdote, but it doesn't stand alone. You know, a few weeks ago, someone came over to me and told me that a palm reader had told him very early in his life that he will have three children and he will live to be 70. It so happened later in life he did have just three children, and he's a few years short of 70, and he asked me for advice. What should he do? What I told him, I'll tell you soon. Before we go on to the next section, and again, what we've established here as at least from the Talmud's viewpoint, there exists such a thing as mazel, something which is basher, in other words, something which is fated even before a person is born. I'd like to dwell a moment on the phenomenon of a shlemazel, someone who's dogged with bad luck. One such historical personage was the famous poet and biblical commentator Avraham Ibn Ezra, who lived in the 12th century Spain. In a poem he once wrote describing his poor fortune, he claimed that his mazel, his luck, was so bad that if he would ever start selling candles, he was certain that the sun would never set. And if he would start selling shrouds, people would stop dying. The word shlemazel, by the way, is a fusion of two words. The German Yiddish word shlim, which has survived in the word shlemiel, which means bad or unfortunate, and the Hebrew word mazel. So shlim means bad, mazel, luck. I once heard, what's the difference between a shlemiel and a shlemazel? If you order soup in a restaurant and your waiter slips and it falls all over you, he's the shlemiel, but you're the shlemazel. So next time you hear the word shlemazel, remember this class. Okay? The next section, start with O, it means ordained. We spoke about something which is or preordained before one is born. But it seems the preordination is only the major contours of one's life, not the particulars. The particulars seem to be decided upon as we go on in life. The first quote we have in this section is on page 3, paragraph A. It's taken from the Talmud, Gemara in Chulin, Zayin Amud Beis in 7b. And Rabbi Hanina, he's the author of the first statement that you remember on page 2, that there's such a thing as mazel. He also says, no one bruises one's finger unless it's decreed in heaven. Everything that happens, we're watched over. When it comes to sicknesses, here we have on paragraph B, there's a Gemara in Avodah Zorah, Nun Hei Amud Aleph in 55a, that there is, and so to speak, there's an oath imposed upon our afflictions. It should start in this and this time. It should last so long, at least minimally so, or maximally so. It departs on a certain date, and through this and this medium or this and this doctor. So even your doctors are beshert. In other words, the view of the Talmud is that it isn't just faded and then we're left, but we're constantly being checked. And not everything that we think is for the worst is actually so. On top of page 4, I quote from you, there's a passage in the Gemara Nida, Lamed Aleph Amud Aleph in 31a. In interpreting a passage that we give thanks to God when he's angry at us. There's a passage in Psalms and Tehillim. It illustrates this passage with a story of two people who were about to embark on a sea voyage. Unfortunately, one of them became injured before he was able to reach his ship. And he felt terrible because his friend had gone and he had missed the boat. And he was cursing. And he was angry until he found out that his friend and the ship sunk. This may be only a mushel. This may only be a parable. But again, I'd like to share with you a story in true life. Again, this is taken from the Holocaust and in the period of the Second World War. When the Nazi regime made it more difficult for Jews to remain in Germany, many Jews took the opportunity and made their way to England. Unfortunately, the Nazis also sent their own spies amongst the Jews. It's a tremendous opportunity for them. Under the guise of being Jews, they would be able to have a finger on the pulse of England and, of course, to transmit the message back to Germany. Scotland Yard was aware of what was happening, and it decided to segregate the Germans. Actually, they classified them originally into three categories. Those who had any ties to the German armed forces were imprisoned. Others, adults, had their travel restricted. The children were free to live and to go, to live with family, designated families. After the events at Dunkirk and the British were in no mood to tolerate the Germans. They decided to make life as miserable as it could for the Germans who had escaped. Of course, again, they did not know who were truly Germans and who were Jews. So they first herded them together into camps, first in London, then in Liverpool. The conditions were horrible. It was cramped. There wasn't much food. And the British authorities offered anyone who desired the opportunity to be deported to Canada. Many of them took the offer. And they went aboard a ship which was called the Dinero. And they were expecting to sail to Canada. Actually, the British had no plans to send them to Canada and actually brought them to Australia. Throughout the trip, the Jews, because the vast majority of them, of course, were truly Jews, were subjected to constant abuse and ridicule. They were harassed and hassled incessantly. None of them was allowed onto the top deck for a breath of fresh air. They were fenced in behind barbed wire to make sure they would remain on the lowest decks of the huge ships. Sailors, crewmen, even the captain would take the Jews' personal belongings away from them, claiming the items would be safe in the hands of the authorities. The British crewmen even issued receipts for the items they took, but the Jews soon realized that the receipts, like the crew's promises, were worthless. This, by the way, is taken from a book called Around the Maggot's Table. If you can get hold of it, it's just a wonderful book. They were going through the Pacific Ocean. The Pacific Ocean was teeming with German Navy ships and with submarines. Late one day, the Dinero barely avoided a near catastrophe when a huge swell miraculously cast the ship out of the way of a fired torpedo. Although the ship was merely grazed by the missile, the English seamen were infuriated and humiliated by the thought they'd almost been blown out of the water. In a fit of rage, they vented their wrath on the German nationals aboard. With calculated cruelty, the British gathered the last possessions that the foreign passengers owned and cast them overboard into the raging waters of the Pacific. The final ties to their past lives, letters, small heirlooms, and treasured books, the items that had made them feel human, were now gone forever. The dark of the night mirrored their despair, and they watched their belongings bobbing, waving in the sea, going under and rising again to the surface as they were tossed from wave to rising wave. Eventually, the Dinero, with its cargo of shattered souls, arrived in Sydney, Australia. All the passengers disembarked there. Soon after, the Dinero began its return voyage to England. A day or so after setting out, the Dinero, with only its British crew members aboard, was torpedoed by German submarines. It exploded, and all on board were killed. A few years ago, a film was released both in England and Australia about the Dinero. The film was very uncomplimentary regarding the British crew members of the ship, as it criticized their callous and ruthless behavior towards the passengers on board. When the British Navy objected to the way its members were being depicted, the Parliament in London began an inquiry to ascertain whether indeed English shipmen decades ago had been cruel and inhumane. As more facts about the incident came to the fore, the diary of the German commander who had torpedoed the Dinero was made public. In it were some incredible entries. It seems that the commander actually tracked the Dinero on its way down to Australia. He had fired a torpedo at the huge ship and was surprised that it hadn't been a direct hit. Shortly afterwards, he and his mates had been ready to torpedo the ship again and blow it up, but as they peered through their periscopes, they noticed suitcases and other paraphernalia floating in the ocean not far from the Dinero. Thinking that the material float might be useful for intelligence gathering, they sent divers to retrieve the items. When the items were brought aboard this German submarine, they were examined carefully. The Germans saw that among the material gathered were personal letters written in fluent German, German books and mementos clearly from Germany. They then realized that there were German nationals on board the Dinero. Therefore, to spare the lives of their fellow countrymen, who were obviously being taken from England to Australia, the German commander ordered his crew not to fire at the Dinero. He radioed all German boats in the area to avoid this ship, as his submarine alone would accompany the Dinero from a distance. And so it was all the way to Sydney. Once the boat had docked and the passenger disembarked, the commander felt assured that there were no more Germans on board. His conscience was now clear. And on the Dinero's return trip to England, the commander attacked and demolished the ship. It's an amazing story. It's interesting that what seemed to be their darkest hour, when all their personal effects were thrown overboard, actually saved their lives. It's not just, it seems, it's not just a mushel. It's the idea that what seems to be the worst is not necessarily so. So the second idea of O is, not only is it preordained, but at least from the view of the Talmud, we are being constantly watched. And decisions are constantly being made. The R is for recklessness. We may think, you know, if it's bashert, it's bashert. You know, there's a Yiddish expression, "Tis yeder koil hot sein adress." In other words, a bullet has its address. So don't worry. You know, go out there, and they're shooting all over. You'll be okay. The Talmud doesn't seem to take that view. When they're shooting, you know, hide. It reminds me of a story, and again, this has nothing to do with this class, but I just read it this week. This was in the Vietnam War, and the soldiers there were being prepared to go on patrol, and they were attending a class in the Saigon Military Academy. And they had gone through over all the steps of what to do in this situation and that situation. And the instructor looked at one of the soldiers there, Private Kaplan. And he says, "Private, you're on patrol in the jungle. One of the Viet Cong now jumps out of the tree. He has a 2-foot knife. What steps do you take?" And he replied, "Big ones." Don't tempt fate. And here on page 4, under R, we quote the Gemara in Shabbos, Lamed Beis Amud Aleph, in 32a. And you could look through yourself. That the sages of the Talmud were quite concerned that if you're in a difficult situation, a miracle may not be wrought. In fact, according to the Midrash, a person is constantly being evaluated, constantly. And when you're in a situation where you may need a miracle to get out of, you may not make it. So the best thing is keep far away. I'd just like to summarize now, and I'd like to go in greater detail in the idea of something is bashert, it's ordained. We spoke about being preordained before one is born. How many children, how long a person lives, one's wealth, one's intelligence, one's strength. The Talmud speaks of the fact that on Rosh Hashanah, we are judged on the new year. What happens to us in the year is decreed. And it is being constantly reassessed. According to the Maharal of Prague, famous rabbi of Prague in the 16th and 17th century, not only are we judged on Rosh Hashanah, but we're constantly being judged. What have we done? How have we changed? We're constantly being nudged. We're constantly moving. And everything that happens to our life does not happen by chance. And this is the view of the Talmud. Is there a method to this madness? Is it just arbitrary? A basic premise of the Talmud is that we are here on this earth only temporarily. Our souls, our consciousness existed before we were born. Our conscious will exist after we die. And we are here on a mission. And that mission is to transform ourselves, to make ourselves better people, more spiritual people, more giving people. And all the judgment that is made takes that into account. Are we moving forward? Are we moving backwards? Are we moving just laterally? And every decision in our life is based on the consideration, what will it do to his or her movement? Will it make the person a better person, a more humble person, or will it make a person a more spoiled person? Is this truly a blessing, or is it a curse? And not only are we macro-managed, but we're micro-managed. And that's part of the idea of mazel as being a malach, you know, this guardian angel. According to the Kabbalah, according to the ancient mystic Jewish tradition, this may not necessarily be the first time we're here on earth. And in fact, the Vilna Gaon, the great Talmudic and mystic sage who lived in the 18th century in Vilna, Lithuania, maintained the whole notion of mazel, something which is preordained. Why is it that one is preordained to be wealthy and another preordained to be poor? One to live a short life and another to live a long life. This predestination is based on considerations of what occurred to us in a previous existence. And we are perhaps not only dealing with issues that we've created in this lifetime, but things that we've created in past lifetimes as well. But all of what occurs to us, the good and the bad, is based ultimately of what kind of people we've made ourselves. And it's just important to realize, only God can judge us, because we don't all start out in a level playing field. That which really connects us all, though, is the question, am I improving or not? Wherever level we are, am I becoming more sensitive, more spiritual, more giving, or am I becoming more selfish, more self-centered, more materialistic? It's a question we always, wherever we are, whichever family we're born into, it's a question we constantly have to ask ourselves. And this leads us to the next section, which is T. As we go, F is fate, that's the predestination. O is ordained, that is on a constant basis. The R is don't do anything reckless, because we are being constantly judged, and you may not make it. You may have the merit to have a miracle done for you. T is teshuva, is repentance. And the Talmud deals with the idea of changing one's fate. Here, this is in the bottom of page 4. Four things cancel the doom of a man, of a person: charity, supplication, change of name, and change of conduct. The Rambam, Maimonides, the famous sage of the 12th century, explained the idea of change of name, of course, is symbolic to say, it's a statement, I'm a new person. One of the most moving parts of the prayers of the High Holy Days is the Nisana Tokef, is the
in vivid terms, the judgment is described in the angels, who will live, who will die. What is the next year going to look like? And at the end of that particular portion of the prayer, the whole congregation cries out in unison, Useshuva, Usefila, Utsedoka, Mavirin Esroya Hagzera. Repentance, prayer, charity will avert the terrible decree. And you see three of those are in this passage here on the bottom of page 4, charity, supplication, and change of conduct. Because basically what it's saying is that we can't expect our fate to change unless we change. And when we speak of charity, and I think charity is a very misunderstood word. We generally think of charity in terms of donations, in terms of money amount. Charity is an attitude. It's a frame of mind. Are we guests on this world, or all the blessings that God has bestowed upon us a means to an end, or is it an end in itself? If we look as just a means to an end, and I'm passing through, and God has given me this blessing and that blessing, and I know and I feel that I have the ability to help other people, to share my blessings in some way, I've changed my whole life. My whole attitude has changed. It's a statement of who I am. It isn't just the money. It's a statement of what the person is. A few months ago, I was at a eulogy, and the rabbi quoted a story. I did not see this in print, so you'll have to forgive me about some of the details. But in general terms, this is the story. It's an amazing story. And again, just illustrates the idea of the important thing of charity is not how much you give, but the attitude in giving. One of the great rabbis of the last generation, his name was Rav Elia Lapian. He was originally from Lithuania. He moved to England and eventually to Israel. While he was in Lithuania, and this was in the middle of the First World War, and he had left the yeshiva where he had taught to raise funds for those who were displaced, for those of the yeshiva who had no means of support because of disruption of the war, he came to a city, and the name escapes me, where the Germans, this is Lithuania at this point, had been occupied by the German army, and they had many prisoners of war. The German commander of the prison, and they had a prison there that was terribly overcrowded, put the Russian non-Jews, the Russian Gentiles, in the barracks of the prison, and put the Jews outside in the prison yard, and it was becoming winter already. They were ill-fed, ill-clothed, and mistreated. And when the rabbi saw what was happening, he came from a different city, this Rav Lapian, he went to the rabbi of the nearest city and asked permission, if he would go with him, to collect funds so somehow to alleviate the suffering of those poor Jews. These were Jews who were prisoners of war. Somehow they could provide some food, some clothing, some blankets, something. And of course the Jews in the city didn't have that much to give themselves, but whatever they had, they willingly shared. And they came to one house. There was a woman who was obviously very distraught. And they told her the story, and she came out and brought a half a loaf of bread. And she says, "My husband has died. I'm left here with three small children. All I have left in this world is a loaf of bread." but what I can give you is half of my loaf. I don't know if the rabbi took it or didn't take it. But one thing it surely indicates is the attitude of someone who's willing to give and to share with others who are in need. According to the Talmud, there's a suggested 10 to 20% of one's income that one should share with those that are in need. But the important thing is not how much you give, that's the dollar amount, but it's your willingness to feel the pain of others and to reach out. And it goes in many ways. Thank God in this country, the Jews for the most part have been blessed materially. Spiritually though, our blessing has been a double-edged sword, so to speak, a coin of two sides. Moment magazine, a few months ago, published a statistic. Again, this is a projection based on current trends of what will occur in the next few generations amongst Jews. They took 200 secular Jews, 200 Reform Jews, 200 conservative Jews, 200 modern Orthodox Jews, and 200 Jews of the Hasidic or Yeshiva orientation. And they projected according to their birth rate from the 200 secular Jews, and again, the numbers may not be exact, but you get the sense in any case. 10 will be Jews. Of the 200 Reform Jews, again, this is based on birth rate and intermarriage. Of the 200 Reform Jews, I believe 19 or around will be Jews. Of the 200 conservative Jews, 54 will be Jews, great-grandchildren. Of the 200 modern Orthodox Jews, something like 700, as they will have, they'll have 700 Ureiniklach, those fourth-generation Jews. And amongst those of the yeshiva, Hasidim, it's like 5,000 and something. It's nice for the yeshivas, but it's a terrible thing for the all of them are Jews. The secular, Reform, conservative, modern Orthodox yeshiva are Jews. Their grandparents stood at Mount Sinai like all of them. And they went through the glory and the persecution that we all went through. And one feels in this country that not only do we have to share materially, but we have to share spiritually. And that doesn't necessarily mean money. It's like the story of the there was a plane that developed engine trouble. It was over the Pacific, and they were very concerned, the crew, what's going to happen with the plane. And they looked through the passengers, and they saw there was a rabbi on the plane, and they approached him, says, "Rabbi, says, maybe you can do something religious." So he got up and started making a collection. generally when we think of do something good, we think of money. The truth is that each and every one of us in this room has something to share. And that's all part of it. It's the attitude. It's an added responsibility. It's not just me. The idea of prayer is equally so not just a matter of form. We always think of prayer like, I can't pray. I don't know the prayers anyway. What prayer do you say here? I was thinking if I had the time to write a book. It says, I would pray, but I just don't know the words. prayer is an attitude. It's not just words. Of course they're words. The Talmud describes, the Gemara in Tainus and Beis Amud Aleph in 2a, that describes prayer as avoda shebelev, the service of the heart. It's an attitude. When you stand up in prayer, basically you're saying, it's not my world, it's God's world. And you surrender yourself. You may list this, I need this, I have this wish list. The important thing is not the wish list. The important thing is to give our lives into God's hands. You know, it's like the story, you know, it's like the old song, he has the whole world in his hand. That's what you do when you pray. And basically you're saying, I did my part, now it's your baby. Now this, it's your world. You brought me here, you have to take care of me. It's an attitude. If you have that attitude, says you're praying. And if you have that attitude, you can appreciate all the more what the form is, because then it starts to make sense. But generally, when we come to pray, we're nagging. You know, hey, you know, I didn't get this yet. It's like Moshe with his ticket here, you know? I didn't get this yet. Hey, what's wrong? That's not what prayer is. The idea of prayer is, and that's why it has the ability to transform oneself. The idea of prayer is we become different people when we pray. I'd like now to go to this next section. Again, fortune here. Again, with fate, with predestination, it's ordained, what happens to us on a day-by-day basis. R, don't be reckless. T, teshuvah, change. And now U is uplifting. We spoke about that which is preordained. And we discussed the opinion of the Vilna Gaon that preordination is very much dependent on reincarnation, what we've done in a previous lifetime. And according to the Talmud, it's much easier to change ordination, that which occurs on a daily or a yearly basis, than preordination, what has been preordained for us before we were born. In fact, Rabbi Hanina maintained the preordination you cannot change. That's fixed. You can only change within that, within those contours. It seems, though, the consensus of the Talmud is that you can change your mazel as well. But it seems to be a unique gift to Jews. That's part of the covenant. That's the promise to Abraham. We can rise above the mazel. We can go above the stars, so to speak. And it gives an example, and I think this also illustrates the idea of what tzedakah really is, what charity is really all about. As I explained before, the sages of the Talmud believed that astrology is a means of determining one's mazel. An astrologist once told Rabbi Akiva, the famed Rabbi Akiva, that his daughter would die on the day she would be married. He was scared. But she... in fact, he said this is exactly what's going to happen. A snake will bite her and she will die. But he had faith in God and he went through the marriage. On the day of her marriage, she took out a brooch. She took something, you know, it's a pin that went into the hair. She stuck it into the wall. They had different walls in those days. And she stuck it into the wall. And by chance, there was a snake there in the wall. She didn't see it. She just took it off, you know, and just stuck it in. And it went to the eye of the snake. The next morning when she took it out, she saw something came with it. There was a snake there. And she told her father, and the father asked, what did you do? He said, well, a poor man came to our door in the evening. And there, a poor man wasn't just collecting for a yeshiva, a shuluch. They didn't have what to eat. And everyone was busy at the banquet, and there was no one to take care of him. So I took my, this is her wedding. She took my portion, and I gave it to the man. She says, you know, Rabbi Akiva said, that saved your life. And he says, Tzedakah tatzel mimavos. Charity saves from death. Not just from an unnatural death, but it saves from death itself. It wasn't the matter of how much she gave. If she was willing to give what seemed the most precious thing, you know, this is her chasana, this is her meal at the chasana, this is her chasana suda. And she was willing to give it and share it, meant she transcended her own nature. God makes miracles for us, changes nature when we change our own nature. And that's really what tzedakah is all about, what charity is all about. Very often, we're afraid to give charity. We're insecure. I mean, you know, charity has to be within limits. I mean, a person is not even allowed to give more than 20% of one's income. But still, this is that you're afraid. Part of giving is you're saying, you know, it's like prayer. I know it's the right thing. God gave me the wherewithal. I could spare it, because if you can't spare it, you just can't spare it. It says, I can spare it. Everything will be all right. You went beyond the limits of your own nature. You transcended your own nature. You've made a minor miracle in your own life. God will change your mazel, and he will make a miracle in your life. He will change if you change. But it's not just change, I'm going to be good. It's a whole attitude. You know, there was a woman, Nebuch, she passed away, but she was diagnosed with cancer some years ago in Israel. And she had a remission. Temporary remission. And she pledged that if she has some time left, she wants to do good. And she went around the country. She was evidently an articulate speaker. She went around the country preaching about the importance of guarding one's tongue. It was to speak well of other people. And she told a story I'd like to share with you about someone who had to go across a river. This was many years ago. This river was not spanned by a regular bridge. It was a makeshift kind of bridge, you know, the kind you see in pictures over gorges in China. You know, the great retreat the Mao Zedong did in the 1930s, you know, over these gorges. That was the kind of bridge it was. And it was a stormy day, and she was going over. She was almost halfway there. And a tremendous wind came, and it was raining, and the bridge was shaking. And she was sure she wasn't going to make it. And she prayed like she never prayed in her life, and she said, God, if I make it through, I'm going to be good. I'm not going to speak any Lashon Hara. I'm not going to speak bad about anyone. She says, I'm going to give charity. I'm going to take care of people. I'm going to change. You'll see, I'll be a different person. And all of a sudden, it became calm. And she started going across the bridge. She was past the halfway mark. She started thinking, you know, it's awfully tough not to speak Lashon Hara, not to speak bad about people. You know, a person shouldn't take, these drastic steps all at once. You know, go slow. You know, I'm being so charitable, like, you know, to take it slow, you know. Anyway, she was backtracking as she's going, and then the wind started up again. It starts, hey, I was only kidding. What the Talmud is saying is that our lives will change when we will change. Why we are given a certain mazel, whether it be challenges in a marriage or in business or children or this or that, our challenges for us to gain, if only to be humbled and to start praying. But if we respond, there's a good chance that our lives will change, our mazel will change, because we've changed. We're different people. I mean, this idea of you change your name, and this is the symbol. We're different people. We've spoken so far about positive change. As a person starts off as being a schlemazel, as having poor fortune, we're changing now to have good fortune. But it doesn't always work that way. Sometimes we could start with good fortune, it could turn around to have bad fortune. And it's all our undoing. And this is really on page 7 here. This is the last page. The Talmud looks at the tongue, the ability to communicate, as one of the greatest gifts that a human has. And that's why a tongue is holy. It shouldn't be misused. It should spread good and not bad. And if one misuses one's tongue, and this is about one speaks foul language, one has really changed his whole complexion, so to speak, from a spiritual person to a very to something which is more akin to an advanced animal. And it says, if you change, your mazel changes. You go up and go down. It doesn't mean necessarily a person was born into wealth and intelligence and wonderful marriage and all the blessings of life that it necessarily will always remain so. It has to be carefully tended to. And that's the end, negativity. And the last, E, is endurance. We've spoken up until now about changing it. Sometimes we have to have patience. The last passage here is a quote from the Talmud. Again, a prediction of an astrologer that came true. There were two great scholars. This is probably the year 300 of the Common Era. And there was a question, who should be the leading rabbi, who should be the head of the yeshiva, be it Rabba or Rav Yosef, the two great scholars. Rav Yosef declined the honor because an astrologer once told him that he will rise, be a star, be ahead of a yeshiva, and afterwards only live for some 2 years. He didn't want to take any chances. I'm in no rush. You know, it's like the story of the, we may have said this in a previous class last year. You know, someone was on death row, and the last night before the execution, custom has it that one is offered one's last meal. And you can ask whatever you want. So they asked this particular, it was the middle of the winter, and he asked him, says, what do you want? He says, I want watermelon. He says, watermelon's out of season. He says, I can wait. Sometimes the good things will come. We have to have patience. Let me just sum up again. What have we said here? We've discussed the idea that what happens to our life is not mere chance. And according to the Talmud's view, our life is carefully guided, even before we're born and afterwards. And we can change it. And we can change it by changing ourselves. I'd like to add, I mean, this is another facet of all of this. Sometimes we go through our lives and we look and we evaluate. And this happened to me and that happened to me and the other thing happened to me. Very often, though, not always, but very often, we really need a reevaluation. There's a story of someone who came to a rabbi and complained. This is no good, and that's no good, and the other thing's no good. And after around 15 minutes of hearing this and that and the other thing, the rabbi went over to the wall, the white wall like this wall, took out a pencil, and made three dots on the wall. And turned to the man and said, "What do you see?" "This rabbi, I see three dots." He says, "What happened with the wall? There's a whole wall there. And all you see is just three dots?" There's a whole life there. But sometimes we get fixated that, no, this is the only important thing in life. And all the other things that another person look at you and be makani, in other words, would only wish he'd be in your position. To you, they're not important. Because you have a certain, you've already set up a certain hierarchy of values. Not only this is important. It reminds me of the story of a well-to-do Jewish man, an immigrant, who after many years of struggle had amassed a small fortune. One day, as he stepped off the curb, a car came in this man's path. Thank God he avoided major injury, but he was knocked down and temporarily lost consciousness. Someone on the scene quickly put his coat over the man to prevent him from going into shock and stood by his side. Before the ambulance finally arrived, the man gained consciousness and began to talk. "Are you comfortable, sir?" his gracious attendant asked. "Yes, thanks God, I make a nice living." This person, my comfort meant a nice living. He was totally oblivious. He's knocked down and Baruch Hashem, he's still alive. I hope, in the lecture in June 2nd, we're going to speak more about how to reevaluate your life. That's how to enjoy the simple pleasures of life. Thank you very much for coming. And the floor is open for any and all questions. Okay. Yes. Yeah. Wait. Oh. Very. Yeah, the question was asked. We started off. Thank you. What did I tell the friend who asked he has a few years to go till he's 70? I told him everything that I told you. I don't know. It may be predestined, but you can change it. And that, by the way, the commentaries explain why we are not allowed to go to astrologers. Because we are supposed to live life with faith. And if we live life with that faith and put our lives in God's hands, it doesn't follow the mazel. We transcend it. Yeah.
My daughter asked a question that we were unable to answer, but I have to pre-qualify it with you before. When you say God preordained our lives at conception, does that apply just to Jews or to everyone?
Okay. The question asked was the idea of predestination, or there may be another one. Let me just, okay. Is it Jews or non-Jews as well? It's to everyone.
She wanted to know why God, who is good, would allow this to happen.
Okay. Well, let me just repeat this question here. Okay. About the idea of a child suffering. This may be a long lecture, but believe me, I really try to keep it as short as I can. As I said before, reincarnation is a central belief in the Jewish mystic tradition, the Kabbalah. There is a, it seems to be a, an axiomatic in the Torah itself that all the suffering that we experience is ordained. And it somehow relates to what we've done or where we're supposed to be at. Either it's a challenge or it's a punishment or it transforms our character, but it's part of a plan. There are there have been studies, and again, it's worthwhile, person, just to read through the studies yourself, about reincarnation memories under hypnosis. And the studies, and again, you know, one could question this study or that study or the other study. It's just the preponderance of the cumulative, the accumulation of all the evidence from all the studies, and plus the fact is that it does support the tradition of the Kabbalistic Jewish tradition, plus the Hindu tradition, plus there are many other traditions that it supports. Under hypnosis, people recall the crimes that they've done in a previous lifetime, and also the connection between what happens to them in this lifetime and what happened to them before. And according to this, and it's not just a belief, at least, and it could still be a belief, but at least there's much evidence to support this, that there really is a relationship between what happened before and what happens now. And there is an accountability and there is a judgment. That's definitely a possibility. So one cannot believe one study. It's a matter of the preponderance of evidence, not just one conclusive book or one conclusive. Yeah, yours, I'm sorry. Yeah. Yeah, sure. That would be best.
The story that you gave about the German submarine that followed its ship, these men very carefully read the papers. They must have come across the fact that these people were Jewish, I believe. And I'm just wondering if that was in their decision not to send the torpedoes, despite the fact that they must possibly, with all this careful scrutiny, must have determined that their activities, that they were Jewish, and therefore decided not to send the torpedoes.
No, my understanding, the question was about the details of that story. My understanding is that from the diary of the submarine commander, that he understood that these were German nationals and not Jews.
But they could see it immediately. First of all, they could see the German language that would indicate immediately, without much scrutiny, that they were German.
They only knew that because they uncovered it from the, and all they saw, they were Germans. They didn't see that they were Jews.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237, or call 1-800-797-7729.